Tansey Beaujeau, this is At the Edge of Canada with TJ Phillips, bringing you weekly check-ins and interviews with all the major players in the Indigenous intellectual community in southern Manitoba and across the country. Welcome to Season 2.2, Winter Semester 2018. We got about a dozen interviews lined up for you this semester with some amazing voices in the creative and academic sectors of the Indigenous intellectual community. We're going to lead it off right here at home at the University of Manitoba with Indigenous graduate student and Métis woman Kathleen Wilson. She's in the master's program, Peace and Conflict Studies, the joint program between the University of Manitoba and the University of Winnipeg. Back in October, Kathleen was one of the co-organizing chairs of the annual International Peace and Conflict Studies Graduate Student Conference, Peace Without Borders. It was a two-day event held between sites at the University of Manitoba and at the University of Winnipeg, where folks across the discipline came together to discuss the theoretical and practical implications of peace building and conflict resolution, that work being done by graduate level researchers in the academy. Kathleen presented. I had a chance to check her out and her work, where she talked about the praxis of theoretical explorations of peace and conflict studies in Indigenous communities. It was a fascinating conversation. We talk about that. We talk about being a graduate student today, an Indigenous graduate student today in a joint program, what it's like to work in peace and conflict studies, a department buoyed up by the contributions of Arthur Morrow, who made another substantial gift to the University of Manitoba this past semester, as well as talking to Kathleen about how to carve out space, Indigenous space in peace and conflict studies, and to amplify Indigenous voice. Kathleen is super smart, and we're so happy to have her kick off this year's edition of At the Edge of Canada. This is Kathleen Wilson on At the Edge of Canada. So what is that, as an Indigenous graduate student in a joint master's program between mm-hmm. two sometimes rivaling universities, mm-hmm. what does that feel like?
Well, I generally find when you have sort of like two elephants in the room, which is exactly what a joint master's program is, they just sort of, they fight for space. So when you talk about, specifically as it pertains to being an Indigenous student, the conversation shifts from the students to how the institutions are managing the students. Hmm. And I think that sometimes that can be a little bit disheartening, because obviously that's not what the focus should be. And then also you end up comparing how they both handle the students and how they both do that. And so even yourself, you stop focusing on your own needs, focusing on your own challenges, and you start instead looking at how the institutions are dealing with them. And then you can end up in that sort of exactly contrarian sort of mindset where you want to fight against it. And sometimes it's valuable, and sometimes it's just a real suck of energy. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, the interdisciplinary and sometimes inter-university programming can get a little complex with the administrative component. And I'm mm-hmm. always curious how students feel like they sit when they belong to two separate entities at the same time.
Well, certainly with this program in particular, about 90% of it is at the U of M. Mm. So, I mean, despite the fact, the joint connection, from my perspective anyway, has been really more about resources. So how many, you know, how many minds can you access? How many books can you access? How many grants can you access? It's not so much about necessarily benefiting from, I guess, institutional structure. It's really about the resources. Mm-hmm. So, and the interdisciplinary nature of it can be really complicated and complex as well. And there's a lot of, you know, everybody speaks to the word inclusive constantly. And then in my field, that's sort of jacked up to a point where it can become a little bit abstract, and then it's not really inclusive. Mm. Yeah.
So Peace and Conflict Studies is an interesting program in the University of Manitoba and the University of Winnipeg because it's mm-hmm. housed in the Faculty of Graduate Studies, mm-hmm. which typically isn't the host for a department or a graduate program. But in this case, Peace and Conflict Studies seems to fit in there. Mm-hmm. And what makes the gears of industry work in the Peace and Conflict Studies is Arthur Morrow and his donations and mm-hmm. support of the program. Arthur just recently made a donation to the University of Manitoba for $5 million. Tell us a little bit about what Arthur Morrow's influence is on the Peace and Conflict Studies department and how you understand Peace and Conflict Studies to exist at the University of Manitoba and the University of Winnipeg.
Well, as you said, like it wouldn't be possible without him. And he's the namesake for the structure in which we function at the University of Manitoba. But I think the whole goal of our field is to find spaces where we can support other people and create those connections and decrease marginalization and really like just get a conversation going with as many people as possible. And he has been able to facilitate that in many ways, both within our program and just at the university level in general. And I think that that type of behavior really embodies what Peace and Public Studies would hope for the people who study or the people who get to be part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say specifically.
Peace and Conflict Studies, as I mentioned, it sits uniquely inside of the Faculty of Graduate Studies at the University of Manitoba. But more broadly, across the country, Peace and Conflict Studies as a discipline goes by, I find, a number of different names.
Yep.
Out east, I've heard it fit underneath Global Development Studies. Out west, I've heard it understood as, you know, International Development and Cultural mm-hmm. Relations. Mm-hmm. How does Peace and Conflict Studies, what kind of discipline is that? And what do you do in Peace and Conflict Studies? What do you research in your own words?
That's a really great question. Actually, I have to say I'm kind of impressed with that. That comes up a lot in our field. Yeah, Peace and Conflict Studies does go under many titles. And even within Peace and Conflict Studies at U of M, that conversation comes up pretty early on. What is Peace and Conflict Studies, and why don't we go by another name? Even the idea of like defining yourself within the field. So are you a peacekeeper, a peace builder, a peacemaker, a peace practitioner? Like there's words and terms in academia in general, but really in our field, especially because it can incite conflict, are mm-hmm. really, really important. I think this is my perspective. So yeah, in my own words, the reason why we're Peace and Conflict Studies and not something maybe more specific like global relations or I remember when I started telling people I was taking Peace and Conflict Studies, they wanted me to define it like, well, is it political science or are you studying international relations?
Right.
Like they really wanted to relate it to structures. And I think we are in many ways inclined to view peace as like a structural issue, and we should, but not necessarily a formal structural issue like in the political arena, for example, or even defining it using borders by calling it, you know, international or global. In Peace and Conflict, what you're studying really is you're doing peace studies and you're doing conflict studies. And conflict studies can range from huge like macro conflict issues like international or global issues and, you know, and those types of subjects. But it can also be very sort of micro level. And like in my research personally, I study a lot of structural violence and intergenerational trauma. And those in and of themselves are conflicts, both like internally within the people who have to experience them, as well as on a global scale or on a bigger scale, community level scale.
Mm.
And then the peace component, sometimes people bring that peace component in where they want to talk about how people in different communities and spaces can create peace within those communities. But again, that can transfer also internally. The last work I did was this emancipatory model for Indigenous women and like looking at how expectations affect us and then how to move forward from that.
Mm.
So the beautiful thing about the field and what I've always respected about it is that it's designed to allow that individual who's studying that subject matter to define it for themselves and to build their own context around the theories.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I've always understood peace and conflict studies since coming to the University of Manitoba mm-hmm. as the research and theoretical conceptualizations and abstraction of mm-hmm. sites of contestation and mm-hmm. how those sites of contestation manifest positive and negative outcomes, and mm-hmm. how can peace, theoretically and broadly construed, mm-hmm. work to facilitate or work to rehabilitate some of those outcomes. And mm-hmm. and in that logical point of contestation, that could be anything from yeah. physical and violent altercation to something like Yoon pointed out, which mm-hmm. is structural and systemic, mm-hmm. like land claim or mm-hmm. indigenous health mm-hmm. or child welfare. And mm-hmm. in those policy and sometimes judicial frameworks, peace and conflict studies can exist and can make important contributions for health outcomes for folks who find themselves near these sites.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that's critical, because I think that structural component and that structural violence, at large as an umbrella term, is very insidious and it's almost invisible. And if you don't have people who are actively studying and pointing those things out and highlighting them, and not even necessarily studying, because I mean, peace, practitioners or peace builders within any community can be anybody. But I think there is space for that academic field to sort of say, there's this community of people and they're feeling really oppressed and they're really, really struggling and they're trying to find a voice. Why are they struggling? Why are they trying to voice? How are they trying to find a voice? And looking into those details, I think that there's peace and conflict studies makes room for that. And I think that's such a critical component to finding peace or reconciliation or whatever term you want to use for that.
One of the spaces that peace and conflict studies as a discipline provided, which you were a lead organizer on, mm-hmm. Was the International Peace and Conflict Studies Graduate Student Conference, the second annual gathering of graduate research focusing on peace and conflict studies, held by the Peace and Conflict Studies Student Association in between University of Manitoba and the University of Winnipeg back in October. It was called Peace Without Borders. And what really that space provided for me, Kathleen, before mm-hmm. I get you to talk a little bit about the administrative component that you were working on, mm-hmm. was bringing together all of these really unique perspectives on sites of contestation mm-hmm. Throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And your panel specifically, there was all different times. I went there to hear conversations by and about Indigenous folks, but all of a sudden there was this huge conversation going about, post-colonial African situations on
yeah.
the continent. And that's not what I was expecting. And so that's what I think I mean by these really unique and colorful sites of conversation about sites of contestation.
Yeah, it was it's funny because I organized that with my colleague Matthias, and he's the president of our student association this year, and but I wasn't on the panel for organizing actually what the structure of the conference is going to look like and who was going to be on whichever panels. We had a subcommittee for that. And so like you, I came in, I mean, I had seen the lineup of individuals and I came in and I wasn't sure what the conversation was going to be. And it's interesting because those conversations sometimes can be a bit disheartening if I feel like, the subject matter that I want to discuss or that I think is important doesn't really get that sort of roundtable discussion. But then at the same time, I always have that lens, and I took so much out of that conversation. I mean, even in the way that it was held and the people who were given the opportunity to speak versus the people who didn't have a voice in that space, I thought that was really interesting. And peace and conflict is like that on all levels, and especially the international component. It just, you're meshing so many different cultures and views and formal behavior that it can be really fascinating, sometimes difficult, but really interesting.
One of the conversations that happened in the Q&A portion, which was a panel surrounding Indigenous peace building as it was built, mm-hmm. was a debate between, it appeared to me, and by the identification of the panelists, that they were African, and what mm-hmm. they were arguing about was whether or not you can subvert mm-hmm. colonial superstructures in advance of Native Afrikaners if you're speaking English. And mm-hmm. that was a really tense conversation
yeah.
for a room full of people speaking English. And basically the protest was, are we really doing anything if we're just doing this in English?
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting point of retrospection, because mm-hmm. can you talk about peace building in a non-peaceful, like, language situation.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic. And actually, Red Rising's 8th issue is actually a language issue, and I'm really looking forward to reading it because I think that conversation is totally valid. I mean, we sort of started this discussion talking about language and how loaded it can be, and when you talk about trying to redefine society or decolonize, if you want to use that very highly contested word, if you want to say that, can you do that when you're still using the language of the oppressor? You know, personally, I think a lot about it, and I'm about as conflicted internally as that conversation was in that room. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The indigenous language edition for Red Rising will be coming out soon, I hope. So the title of your particular paper was The Merits of Considering the Spherical Cow, mm-hmm. Weaving Together Peacebuilding Theories in the Context of Violence Against Indigenous Peoples in mm-hmm. Canada. Give me the elevator speech of that paper.
So the elevator speech of that paper is that I love theory. I've always liked it, which is why I titled it The Spherical Cow, because it's one of my favorite theories. It's just an absurd concept, and there's a joke that goes with it, which if you heard the beginning of my speech, you know I don't do very well, so I'm not going to say it again. But my idea was to just bring some of my theory, and I started with a non-Indigenous theory. I wanted to talk about The Moral Imagination by Jean-Paul Lederach, but I wanted to bring that Indigenous lens to it to say, okay, so there are these theories, and they're really amazing, and you can transfer them from context to context, but I just want to remind you that some of these theories have existed for many, many years beyond this individual coming and highlighting it. And so that's why it was important to bring in the peacekeeping circles, because they just weave together so beautifully, and it shines a light on some of the things that Indigenous communities have been doing for a long, long time that sometimes get missed because they're not packaged the same way as other theories.
Mm.
So I wanted to bring the theory. I wanted to talk about that trans-context kind of ability of theory and then do so by incorporating the lens that's really important to me.
One of the notes, or you seem to put your finger on a crucial pressure point or intersection mm-hmm. about the difference between theories of peace building
mm-hmm.
with and for Indigenous communities in Canada and the praxis mm-hmm. of theories of peace building when we go from talking about it to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see your own work sitting in that spectrum?
Well, I think that my philosophy on life, we talked a little bit earlier about how I view things, and it's always a very relational level. So it can be personal relationships. It can be relationships that I have within the structures within which I function.
Mm-hmm.
And I try my best to incorporate that theory into the practice of my everyday life within those relationships. Mm. Like, I'm just hyper aware of that, and studying allows me to put even more of that into practice, because mm-hmm. I gain that additional awareness and I gain extra strategies. And one of the steps that's it's in peacemaking circles, but highlighted in more general way in Jean-Paul Lederach's work, is that in order to find peace, you need to function within ambiguity. And for me, it's very difficult to function. I think actually for most people, it's very difficult to function with ambiguity. Most people are really committed to finding the binary and then choosing a side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my work is about recognizing the binaries and acknowledging them, and then functioning within that ambiguity and being creative about it, and being caring, as caring as you can, because you can't always, for me anyway, you can't really move forward if you don't branch and weave with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if that still really kind of sounds like a theoretical concept, but for me it is a very physical, lived, everyday experience.
It does sound like something from a theoretical point of view that I might call empathetic relativism. Empathetic to yourself, be okay mm-hmm. with that relativism, but also empathetic for points of view that may be more absolutist, and mm-hmm. in that is a theory or a praxis for peace building. One of the spaces you draw on for intellectual support and cultural support on this are indigenous theories and nation-specific indigenous theories of peace building. How do you carve out space for indigenous vocalizations in peace and conflict studies?
How do I personally carve a space, or how does peace and conflict studies carve a space?
Whatever point of view makes it more comfortable to answer.
Well, my tone is going to change for this discussion. So peace and conflict studies is a structure itself. It exists within another structure, actually two, because we're a joint program. That exists within another structure, which is our government system and the way that our country runs. And because of that, I'm a little bit pessimistic, and I'm inclined to say that the way that we incorporate our structures, the way that that Indigenous voices are incorporated, is still sort of it's almost like a token, like, okay, we're going to be inclusive, and then we're going to give this grant. Like, I think it was last year I received a grant from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, gave me some money. And I'll take the money. I'm happy to take the money. But it at the same time, it really had that feeling of, you're giving me this because you're doing your due diligence, not because you really care about what I have to say necessarily. Mm. And I sometimes find that's what it feels like in a classroom when, for example, on the last day of class in a course, they decide to talk about, oh, well, and this is how indigenous subject would fit into this idea, or this is the theory, or this is the lens that we can just kind of touch on quickly in order to give that space. And I find similarly when it comes to feminist issues that happens as well. Like, you can have a whole course on human rights and it'll run for six, for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then we have like a half an hour where we talk about, oh, these are just specific human rights as they relate to women. So it never really feels like it's a fully fleshed out thing or thought out or really committed to it. It always just feels like, let's give you your minute because maybe you earned it. So I sometimes struggle a little bit with that idea.
That's really interesting. Yeah. As a Métis person, I'm certain that your contributions are essential. And as you mentioned, you're carving out space in this area where maybe the landing pad isn't fully developed for where and how that can work.
Yeah.
I find that really compelling. In your mind, what field do you think your research will be best utilized? Is that going to be in law? Is that going to be in policy? Is that going to be in politics? Is it going to be in theoretical abstraction? Where do you see mobilizing your work to make the most sense as a graduate student in peace and conflict studies?
To answer that question, we would probably need about 2 or 3 hours.
Perfect. We got 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay, 2 or 3 minutes. Well, it's difficult to answer that question without giving any context to who I am as a Métis person.
How about then? Yeah. How about in your mind, where is one place you'd like to see it go then? One field you'd like to see it mobilized in?
If I could choose one place to see it mobilized in, I would really like to see Métis women in my generation find a space of peace with their own identity and feel like they have a voice in whatever room or whatever structure or whatever arena that they happen to find themselves in. I think there's a tremendous internal conflict with women who are in my position. And again, that's why it's difficult to not bring the context of my own life into the discussion. Right. But I think that's critical. And I always bring the feminist lens to my work because I didn't in that particular presentation that you came to, but about 95% of the time I bring that view to it because it's really important to me. But so that's what I would say. I would say that it's about speaking to people who are having that identity conflict due to their life experiences and hopefully connecting more of them.
Yeah,
and giving some peace and space to people.
Some of the strongest Métis thinkers that I and Métis female thinkers that I can think of Sometimes they find themselves at a starting point, and I hope for those who are listening that I'm not trying to tell your own story, but I do find that they house themselves in a department, and then they notice that maybe this department or this discipline isn't speaking directly to the needs of Indigenous women or even Métis women specifically and what they encountered, and they carve out their own space. Zoe Todd writing about fish cosmologies out at Carleton while being housed in sociology is a really curious, you know, parallel to that, or Chelsea Vow, who was trained in law, now working in Native studies around notions of identity and application. So there is that wiggle room, and I think you point to that really nicely.
Yeah, the wiggle room, and that's it. That's why when trying to answer that question, it's something that's always growing. And in my emancipatory model that I developed, my takeaway from that was that your life is your own narrative. And if we try to define our lives using the expectations of other people, the expectations of time, and even our own expectations of who we should be based on our interactions, then we are actually just maintaining that level of oppression. And so defining what this means for my future is something that I do vary with a lot of trepidation and a lot of hesitation.
Yeah, that makes sense. Graduate Student Conference happens annually in October, and I'm sure it'll be an awesome collection of graduate research next year as well. Kathleen, I'm going to get you out of here on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I ask all my guests this because I'm curious to know who you're reading and who you're into, but who would you say is your Indigenous intellectual crush right now?
Kim Anderson.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And how come?
Oh, she just does an amazing job taking the voices of elders and spiritual leaders and incorporating them into her work. So she's a theorist as well, but she makes sure to add that context every time that she writes. And I read her book, and it's just, when I read her writing, I just end up with pencil marks all over the page. My books are dog-eared, because I find that she just brings insight beyond herself. So, I mean, she's my favorite writer, but in a weird way, she's almost more like a facilitator to other people's knowledge, which I think a really good writer should be.
Mm-hmm.
And she facilitates that beautifully, and I'm tremendously appreciative for her work.
Kim Anderson, one of the leaders in Indigenous feminisms and Indigenous masculinities, actually, as she is championing the cause for theoretically studying different notions of Indigenous gender and sexuality. So she was actually here in Winnipeg this last spring giving a presentation at the U Winnipeg. Kim's an awesome contributor to the field.
Yeah.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us, and
for
everything you do in the name of Indigenous resilience, peace building, Indigenous influence, bringing Indigenous notions and theories and representations of self into the academy, and just being a rock star Indigenous woman yourself. Thank you so much for all you do, and thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Trevor. Have a great day.
At the Edge of Canada is produced at the UMFM studios on the University of Manitoba campus in Winnipeg, Manitoba. The University of Manitoba is situated on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. You can get all updated podcasts and live streams for At the Edge of Canada at umfm.com, or you can listen to us live on the UMFM app. The lead track is Nehewak Starlight. And if you like what you hear from me, you can follow me on Twitter at TFillers. Up next, your campus today. I win a little.